realizing our full potential as human beings. This is a goal many of us share, a goal most never achieve. But you now have in your possession a wonderful guide which will help empower you toward control of your thinking, your attitude, your outlook. A guide which will lead you through the steps needed to access that personal power for greater success, prosperity, and peace of mind. The Nightingale Conan Corporation is pleased to present Brian Tracy with his classic program, The Psychology of Achievement. In this 6-cassette program, you'll get time-proven methods in putting your naturally creative mind to work. Over the years, thousands have attended Brian Tracy's achievement seminars, and many report incredible results after applying these techniques. Now, in a well-balanced, practical approach to self-actualization, Brian explains the importance of your success instincts and how a positive self-concept leads the way, how eliminating guilt and accepting responsibility for your life contribute to taking charge of your own destiny. While greatly improving your self-esteem, you'll find out how to get what you want, not what you fear. Brian Tracy discusses the vital process of goal setting and goal achieving and how it relates to wise management of our time. To complete this set of 6 invaluable keys to personal success, Brian Tracy talks about our phenomenal powers of creative problem solving and how we can develop winning relationships with others. Through successful careers in real estate, sales, and marketing, and through assisting multi-billion-dollar companies in turning their desires into achievement, Brian Tracy is well prepared to present these methods. One of the leading authorities on the development of human potential, Brian is president of the Institute for Executive Development, a human resources company based in San Diego, California. He's an enthusiastic athlete, a world traveler, an avid reader and student, and a lover of life. Let's begin now our voyage of self-discovery with Brian Tracy.
Welcome to The Psychology of Achievement. For many years, people have been asking the question, why are some people more successful than others? Thousands of studies have been conducted, tens of thousands of hours have been spent, and millions of dollars have been invested seeking the answers. Many leading thinkers, writers, and researchers have spent their entire lives investigating this one question. Why are some people more successful than others? Why is it that some people make more money, have more friends, enjoy better health, and derive greater satisfaction from life than others do? The purpose of this course, The Psychology of Achievement, is to answer that question by bringing together the very best knowledge available in one complete package, which you can then use to unlock your personal potential to achieve anything you really want in life. Thousands of men and women have already participated in this seminar and are now using these ideas, methods, and techniques to bring about dramatic improvements in their lives. Graduates from this course have gone on to develop new high levels of self-confidence and personal power. They have doubled and tripled their incomes, started new businesses, and vastly improved the operation of existing businesses. They've changed their personalities to become more patient, kind, and loving human beings, and have transformed their personal relationships, especially with their spouses, their children, and other loved ones. They've used these methods to lose weight, quit smoking, and to enjoy greatly improved levels of health and energy, and physical and mental well-being. In fact, the material taught in this seminar is so powerful, so practical, and so usable that many graduates have said that it's like getting a brand new chance at life or receiving a blank check on the future. The material contained in this cassette program is based on exhaustive research, my own 20 years and many more years on the part of other experts in the development of human potential. All high-achieving men and women practice these methods and techniques, whether or not they are consciously aware of it. Anyone can achieve at higher levels than they ever dreamed possible if they will take these ideas and run with them. In fact, we have recently reached the conclusion that there is no real limit on what you can achieve with your life if you will make the success system taught in this program an integral part of your day-to-day activities. Your future will be unlimited when you begin to practice the psychology of achievement. We have often called this a success seminar. So let's start off by defining what we mean by success. There are basically 6 requirements for success. Everything you could ever want can be subsumed under these 6 categories. The first of the six requirements is peace of mind. All the great religions and metaphysical philosophies and works in psychology are aimed at giving and showing people how to achieve far higher levels of peace in mind, because we intuitively recognize that without peace of mind, nothing else has very much flavor. By peace of mind, we mean simply freedom from fear, freedom from anger, and freedom from guilt, perhaps the three major psychological problems of the 20th century. Peace of mind that passeth all understanding, the feeling that going to sleep at night completely at peace and at harmony with ourselves and waking up in the morning with the same state of mind. The second requirement for success is high levels of health and energy. We know that no matter what we have in life, if we do not have our health or if we do not have the energy to enjoy our lives, we don't get very much satisfaction out of it. And as soon as we achieve any kind of peace of mind, we immediately turn to achieving higher levels of health and physical energy. The third requirement for success is loving relationships, the ability to enter into and maintain long-term, intimate, mature relationships with other people. And we know in our studies of healthy human beings that loving relationships are really the hallmark of the self-actualizing, fully functioning personality. As soon as we've achieved a certain level of peace of mind and a certain amount of health and energy, our thoughts immediately turn to our relationships with other people. The fourth requirement for success is what we call financial freedom. And financial freedom means that we have enough money so that we don't worry about money. For one person, this can be $10,000 a year. For another person, $100,000 a year wouldn't be enough. But it's absolutely essential that we achieve the point of financial freedom where we are not preoccupied with where our next rent check is going to come from or where our next paycheck or where the money to pay our bills is going to come from, because we cannot enjoy life if we're preoccupied with money. The fifth ingredient for success is worthy goals and ideals. As human beings, we are not capable of functioning at our best unless we have clear goals to which we are committed and worthy ideals which we believe in. And many writers have said that man's need for meaning and purpose is the greatest single drive in human nature, and I think that that's very, very true. And we'll talk later on in this course about how we establish worthy goals and how we move toward them on a step-to-step basis. And finally, the sixth ingredient of success is a feeling of personal fulfillment, or what Abraham Maslow called self-actualization, the feeling that we are becoming everything that we are capable of becoming as human beings, that we are fulfilling our full potential as we move along. And this feeling of personal fulfillment, this sense of self-actualization, is the hallmark of the truly mature, fully functioning human being. Now, we all measure our success relative to our ability to enjoy more of these six ingredients of a well-rounded life. And again, we come back to our question, why is it that so few people can be described as successful? We live in the richest, most abundant society in all of human history. We have living standards and opportunities undreamed of just a few years ago. And still, the vast majority of men and women, as Thoreau said, lead lives of quiet desperation. They're unhappy with their work, they're unhappy with their families, they're unhappy with their health, they're overweight, they smoke too much or drink too much or worry about their bills all the time. Less than 5% achieve any real lasting success in life. At least 80% of all people reaching retirement age in our society today end up flat, broke, penniless, dependent upon others for survival. Only 5% or less achieve financial independence in their lifetimes, in spite of 40 years or more of well-paid work and limitless opportunity to learn and grow and improve themselves. One of the reasons for this lack of success, I think, is that we come into the world with no instruction manual. We are born as the most advanced and complex organism in our universe, but we have no directions for getting the very most out of ourselves as a human machine. It would be exactly the same as if we went to the store and bought a personal computer and took it home and set it up and found that we had no instruction manual, no operating instructions to tell us how to use the machine to get the very most out of it. As human beings, we're exactly the same. We come into the world with no instruction manual, and we spend the majority of our lives, the vast part of our lives, trying to figure out how to get the very best out of ourselves. And it takes about 30 or 40 or 50 years to do it, and then, as the old German expression says, too soon old, too late smart. We finally figure out how to do it, and we're in our 50s and in our 60s. One of the purposes of this course is to serve as an instruction manual for getting maximum performance out of ourselves. Now, in operating a machine or in operating ourselves, the very first thing that is necessary is we have to understand how to operate ourselves as a human machine. Understanding of the basic underlying principles, laws, and concepts of our being is absolutely essential. And the second part is effort. Once we understand how we work, we have to make efforts so that we can apply what we have learned to achieving far higher levels of accomplishment and attainment in our day-to-day life. Most people, unfortunately, lack the understanding, and if they do have any understanding at all, they're not willing to make the necessary efforts. As a result of this program, you will find that it is much easier to make those efforts on a consistent basis than not. So let's begin by discussing the basic rules or laws for operating the human machine, for getting the very best out of ourselves. I'd like to begin by introducing some basic principles or laws that we'll be coming back to over and over again as we go along. First of all, is the law of control. The law of control is an essential law in understanding how we function, and many psychologists, if not most psychologists today, have come to the conclusion that the degree of control that we feel we have is in direct proportion to the amount of mental health that we have. The law of control simply says that we feel good about ourselves to the exact degree to which we feel we are in control of our own lives, and that we feel bad about ourselves or we feel out of harmony with ourselves to the exact degree to which we feel we are controlled by outer circumstances, by other people, by things beyond our control, if you like. Psychologists call this the difference between an internal locus of control, a feeling that we're behind the steering wheel of our own lives, and an external locus of control, a feeling that somebody else is controlling our lives and taking us where they want us to go. Control begins, first of all, with our thoughts, what we think, and that controls our feelings, what we feel, and leads to how we perform or our actions. But all control begins with taking control of the thoughts we hold in our conscious mind. The second principle or law is a metaphysical concept called the law of accident. The law of accident says, in effect, that there is no way that we can control what happens to us, that everything just happens by accident, that it's not what you know, it's who you know, it's the way the cookie crumbles, it's being in the right place at the right time. Unfortunately, whether they realize it or not, the vast majority of men and women live their lives by the law of accident. By failing to plan, they're planning to fail. They have no goals beyond the short term. They make no plans. They don't really feel that they're in control of their own destiny, and they just hope that somehow things will work out all right for them. One of the major reasons we have so much negativity and disharmony and unhappiness and misery and skepticism in our society is that most people feel like bump cars in a carnival, that they go off in one direction or another depending upon the next incident that happens to them. And of course, people who live by the law of accident can have no sense of control or mental well-being. Opposed to the law of accident is what we call the law of cause and effect. Now, the law of cause and effect is really the basic law of the universe. It's the law of the cosmos. It is the reason that everything happens. And the law of cause and effect simply says this, that for every effect in our lives, there is a specific cause. That if we do not like the effects that we are enjoying in our life, it is up to us to identify the causes and change the causes. That irrespective of whether or not we know what the causes are, there is a reason for everything that happens. There is, in fact, no such thing as an accident. Everything that happens in our life happens by law and not by chance, and that it is our primary duty to understand the laws that control our destinies, and by understanding the laws, we can control the causes and change the effects to anything that we want. You will recognize immediately that the law of cause and effect is completely consistent with the law of control, because if we can identify the causes, we can control the effects and therefore control what happens to us in our lives. And people who live happy, fully functioning, harmonious lives are people who live by the law of control and understand the law of cause and effect in their lives. Under the law of cause and effect, there is one major application which we will return to again several times, and that is simply this. It is that thoughts are causes and conditions are effects. That our thoughts are always the primary causes of the conditions or effects in our lives. That we control our lives by our thoughts, that everything that we are today is the sum total result of all the thinking that we have done to this moment. That if we wish our lives to be different in the future, we have to change our thinking in the present, and by so doing, we change the direction of our lives. There are three mental laws which I'd like to introduce now in addition to the law of control and the law of cause and effect. And the first of these three mental laws is what we call the law of belief. The law of belief simply says that whatever you believe with feeling, becomes your reality, that you are the sum total result of all of your belief systems to this moment, and that your beliefs form a screen of logic or a screen of prejudices through which you see the entire world, that you never allow in any information that is inconsistent with your beliefs, and that even if you have beliefs that are totally inconsistent with reality to the degree to which you believe these things to be true, they become true for you. The law of belief is referred to in every book of religion, in the Talmud, in the Torah, in the Koran, in the Bible. In the Bible it says, as a man thinketh in his heart, or as a man believeth in his heart, so is he. Or, according to your faith, it is done unto you. In other words, according to how deeply you believe it, it is done unto you. The law of belief is so powerful in our lives that even if we hold beliefs that are based on totally false information, they have an impact on what happens to us and an impact on our effects. I'll give you a very good example. A couple of years ago, a young man from a small Midwestern school got straight A's straight through high school and then wrote the college entrance exams, what are called the SAT test or the Scholastic Aptitude Test for entrance into the state university. He got his exam results back and a letter from the university a few weeks later that said that he had scored 98 on the SAT test and was being admitted into the university. Now, the young man did not know what a SAT score was. And when he got a 98 on the SAT score, he was convinced that it meant that he had a 98 IQ. Now, a 98 IQ is a below average IQ and is about 20 points less than is necessary for college entry work. He went off to school, and in the entire first semester of college work, he got straight D's. He either failed or almost failed in every single class that he was in. At the end of the first semester, his counselor called him in and asked him, what is the problem? You got straight A's in high school. The coursework that you're doing here is only a year advanced from your high school work. Why is it you're having such difficulty with these courses? He said, well, sir, you can't really blame me because, you know, I only have a 98 IQ. And the counselor, who had his file in front of him, said, where did you get this idea? He said, well, I got it in my entry letter to the university. It said that I'd been accepted and that I got 98 on the SAT test. He said, young man, he said, a 98 on a SAT test is not an IQ rating. It is a percentile rating. And the young man didn't understand what a percentile was, and the counselor explained that a 98 meant that he had scored equal to or better than 98% of all the students writing entry exams to colleges and universities in North America that year, that he was one of the brightest students in the university, if not one of the brightest students in the entire country. When the young man understood clearly that it was not a 98 IQ, but it was a 98 percentile, he turned around, he went back to his classes, and in the next semester he got straight A's. This was reported in Psychology Today and is consistent with hundreds of different experiences that people have had. The most important single application of the law of belief is this, is that if we have self-limiting beliefs, irrespective of whether or not they are based on reality, to the degree to which we believe them, they become true for us. And most of the beliefs that we have that limit or impair our effectiveness, the self-limiting beliefs are not based on reality at all. They are based on information that we have taken in from a variety of sources, often starting in early childhood, but to the degree to which we accept those ideas as true, they become true for us, and we live in a manner consistent with them. As a matter of fact, our mind works in such a way that it edits out or refuses to allow in any evidence that is contrary to what we have decided to believe. So if we have positive experiences that indicate that we have competence or ability in a particular area where we have believed or decided that we have no competence or ability, we will mentally screen it out. We will engage in a process of what is called selective perception. We will not see the examples that indicate that we are competent. We will only see the examples that indicate that we are lesser in our abilities in those areas. The next law is what we call the law of expectations. The law of expectations is a very powerful concept that simply says that whatever we expect with confidence becomes our own self-fulfilling prophecy, that we are continually acting as our own fortune tellers by the way we talk to ourselves about how we think things are going to turn out in our lives, that people who enjoy high levels of accomplishment are continually talking to themselves and about themselves as though they expected things to work out well. They are manufacturing their own self-fulfilling prophecies and continually looking forward to things happening in a good way for them. People who have unfortunate or unhappy lives are continually talking about the future turning out poorly. The work in expectations theory is exhaustive. We know today in economics that the economic condition of the country next year, 2 years, 3 years will almost be totally related to the expectations of the chief actors in the economy today. If we expect higher inflation, people raise their prices, they raise their wage demands, they raise their wage rates, and lo and behold, next year, the year after, we have inflation. Everybody says, there, I told you so, I knew we were going to have it. Expectations have a powerful impact on our relationships with others, and they have a powerful impact on what we become in our lives. Dr. Robert Rosenthal of Harvard University has conducted over 300 experiments in what he calls expectations theory to test the impact of expectations based on totally false information. And after several years of experimentation, he conducted a famous experiment in the San Francisco Bay Area in the late 60s, an experiment which has still not been absorbed into modern education and which many people have since duplicated and tested and tried in different ways personally and on a large scale, and it happens to work out exactly the same way each time. At the beginning of the school year, the school principal called three teachers into his office. To these teachers, he said, as a result of your teaching excellence over the last 3 or 4 years, we have come to the conclusion that you are the best teachers in this school. And as a special reward to you, we have identified 3 classes each of 30 students of the brightest children in this school, the highest IQ students in this school, and we are going to assign them to you. You're going to have 1 class of 30 students each to teach for the entire year. Now, we don't want to be accused of discrimination, so it's very important that you do not tell these children in any way that you know that they have been selected for a streamed class. And second of all, we're not going to tell their parents because we don't want to cause any difficulties there. We expect you to teach exactly the same way you normally do and use exactly the same curriculum, and we expect you to get very good results with these students. At the end of the school year, these students led not only the school but the entire school district in academic accomplishment. Their grade levels were 20% to 30% above the grade levels of the entire school. They called the 3 teachers in at the end of the year, and they said, well, you've had a very good year. And they said, yes, we have. They said, it was so easy. These children were so easy to teach. They were so eager to learn. It was such a pleasure to teach them. They said, well, maybe we better tell you the truth, that this has been an experiment, and that those 90 children were chosen out of the school population at large. And when we assigned them to your class at the beginning of the year, we had no idea what their IQs were at all. And the teacher said, well, that's incredible, but how could it be that they scored so highly, they did so well, they got such good grades, that, aha, yes, it must be because we are such excellent teachers. At which the principal said, and I think we should also tell you the other side of the experiment, was that at the beginning of the school year, we put all the teachers' names in a hat, and yours were the first 3 names that were drawn. This is what is known as a double-blind experiment. They held constant for everything except expectations. And in both cases, the expectations were based on totally false information. The expectations of the school administration on the teachers, we expect you to do an excellent job, were based on totally false information about their competence or ability. The expectations of the teachers on the students were never spoken, but also based on totally false information. And in both cases, they had dramatic results and achieved dramatic effects as a result. Many teachers and many school systems are now using the results of this work to encourage children to accomplish at far higher levels than they have ever achieved before by telling them that they expect them to do well, that they expect them to be outstanding, that they expect them to get good grades, that they expect them to learn more and to learn faster. Marva Collins, the famous Chicago school teacher, found that by taking ghetto youngsters who had never got above a D in their lives and immersing them in a climate of positive expectations and supportive interaction, they could move to straight A's within 1 semester, sometimes within 30 days. Children that had never gotten above a D could be getting in the 90s in every single subject under the climate, the psychological climate created by the teacher. With regard to expectations, there are 3 key areas where expectations affect our results. The first area is the expectations that our parents had of us, and in many cases still have of us, have a dramatic impact on how we perform today. As adults, of course, the expectations that our bosses have of us have a dramatic impact on how we think about ourselves and how we perform in the workplace. The second area of expectations is the expectations we have of our children, our spouses, our subordinates, and the people who look up to us. We find that people who look up to us always try to fulfill our expectations of them, whether they are positive or negative. Many parents and many employers have revolutionized their family or their corporate environments by changing the climate of expectations and making it perfectly, sincerely clear that they expect the very, very best from the people who look up to them. And the people who look up to them invariably do everything they possibly can not to disappoint those expectations. The third area of expectations that is important to us, and perhaps the most important of all, is the expectations that we have of ourselves. We will always tend to fulfill our own expectations of ourselves, whether they be high or low, whether they be positive or negative. And that's why it is so important in everything that we do to always expect the best from ourselves. Always expect ourselves to continue to grow, to get better, to improve, to throw off past mistakes and failures, because we will always fulfill our own mistakes. We are always the fortune tellers in our own lives. We are always creating our own self-fulfilling prophecies. The third mental law that we'll talk about at this time is called the Law of Attraction. Now, there are hundreds of books that have been written on this subject of the Law of Attraction. And basically what the Law of Attraction says is that each human being is a living magnet, that we radiate thought energy, and that we invariably attract into our lives the people and circumstances that harmonize with our dominant thoughts. That our lives are right now, today, surrounded by and representations of our dominant thought patterns. That if we wish to attract different people, different circumstances, different events, we have to change the content of our conscious minds, because we go through life like a magnet, always attracting to ourselves the people, the events, the circumstances, the good or bad fortune that harmonizes with our dominant thoughts. When a person is feeling very positive, feeling very good about themselves, feeling very up on life, it's remarkable how many good things, good situations, good circumstances they attract to themselves. And when a person is feeling negative and pessimistic and cynical and down on themselves, it's amazing how many negative situations they experience and how many negative people they meet. And these happen by law, not by chance, that we can dramatically improve the quality of our lives by understanding these essential mental laws, by taking control of our minds, by manufacturing our beliefs so they are consistent with what we want to happen to us, by manufacturing expectations consistent with what we want to happen in our future, and by thinking continually of the people and circumstances we want to draw into our lives. Earl Nightingale set history many years ago by his record called The Strangest Secret, in which he came to the conclusion that you become what you think about. The most important single breakthrough in understanding of human nature in this century is summarized in those words, that you become what you think about. As Ralph Waldo Emerson said, a man becomes what he thinks about all day long. And we could probably summarize these opening comments by reminding you that you are not what you think you are, but what you think you are. Going on, we come to the subject of attitude. We know that since we become what we think about, the most outwardly identifiable characteristic or manifestation of what we're thinking about is our attitude. And we know that a positive mental attitude is an absolutely indispensable prerequisite for success. A study at Harvard University a few years ago amongst executive recruiters came to the conclusion that 85% of everything that a person would accomplish or attain in terms of finance, money, prestige, status, recognition, after they left Harvard University would be based on their attitude and only 15% on their aptitude or ability. In fact, over the years, they have found that there is absolutely no correlation whatever between grade level coming out of high school or university and lifetime earnings, that there is no way that they can match the two at all. The only characteristics that determine how well a person does and how far they go are attitudinal, in at least 85% of cases. The Cox Report on American Business said unequivocally that as many as 94% of the top executives of Fortune 500 corporations attributed their success more to attitude than to any other ingredient. We know that a positive mental attitude is essential for success. We've been told all our lives that we have to improve our attitude, we have to smarten up our attitude, we have to get our attitudes right. We've been told that we have to have a positive attitude, and there are books and tape courses and seminars that tell people to have a positive attitude. So our question has been, why is it that with all of this information, so few people have positive attitudes? We know that if you could buy a bottle of pills at the drugstore and take them along with your orange juice in the morning, the same as you take a vitamin C pill, and have a positive mental attitude all day, everybody would do it. So our question has been, Where do attitudes come from? And that brings us to our old friend, expectations. Our attitudes come from our expectations about outcomes. If we expect things to turn out well, we have positive attitudes. If we expect things to turn out poorly, we have a tendency to have negative attitudes. Let me give you an example. Imagine that you live in Los Angeles, and you have put together the most important project of your life, and you are short of funds, and you decide to invest everything that you have in flying to New York to find a backer for your project. And you fly to New York on a Sunday, and you have a whole series of appointments lined up on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And you start off Monday morning, and you go out to see people. And everybody that you go and see turns you down flat, rejects you cold, tells you that they're not interested in your proposal, that it's harebrained, that it's too expensive, that it's ill thought out. And this is the most important project you've ever put together in your life. And you go from interview to interview, and every single person turns you down and shuts the door and rejects you. And this happens all day Monday, and it happens all day Tuesday, and it happens all day Wednesday. And by Wednesday night, you're totally exhausted. You're totally dispirited. You're discouraged. You don't have any energy at all. And you crawl back to your hotel room, and you close the door, and pick up the telephone and phone home. The person who picks up the telephone on the other end of the line, recognizing that you're feeling discouraged, says, "Cheer up. Don't feel so bad. It doesn't matter anyway, because we've just won $1 million in the lottery." Now let me ask you, what would happen to your spirits that moment when you learned that you'd won $1 million? Now would you have to think about it for 10 or 15 minutes? Or would something happen to you instantaneously? Instantly you learned that you'd won $1 million. All your fatigue, all your depression, all of your aggravation, all of the rejection of the last 3 days would disappear from your mind, and the only thing that you would think of is the fact that you had that $1 million and all the opportunity and affluence and possibilities that that represented. You'd be filled with energy and excitement and enthusiasm. Now, let us say that you had committed yourself to 2 more days of appointments, and you were going to see those appointments through because you're a responsible person. And you go out the next day to your appointments one after another. How much more likely would you be to be successful in those appointments knowing that you had $1 million waiting for you when you got home? How much more enthusiastic would you be? How much more confident? How much more forceful? How much more positive would you be? How much more likely would people be to respond positively to your proposal on Thursday and Friday rather than the way they did on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday? Well, let us assume that you finish your appointments, you jump on the airplane that afternoon, you fly all the way home to Los Angeles, you jump in your car, you race home, you run in the door, you kiss whoever it is that's there, and you say, "Where is it?" And the person says, "April Fool, I was just kidding. I recognized that you were feeling a little bit tired and discouraged, and I thought I would just tell you something to cheer you up." Now, after you had finished strangling whoever it was, you might ask yourself this question: was your attitude real or not? Were your feelings truly positive and excited and enthusiastic or not? And the answer that you'll come up with was, yes, your attitude was real. Your feelings were real. Your level of energy, your enthusiasm, your vitality, your excitement were all real, because those are not the sort of things that you can artificially manufacture, even though the expectations upon which they were based were totally false. If you can understand the importance of this concept, you'll have one of the keys to understanding why some people are far more successful than others, in that what winners make a habit of doing is manufacturing their own positive expectations in advance of the event. They have an attitude of positive self-expectancy, in that well before something good happens to them, they are expecting something good to happen, expecting the very best to come out of their efforts. They are manufacturing their expectations even though they have no information upon which to base it, which causes them to have positive, enthusiastic attitudes, which causes them to affect people in a positive way and get positive reactions. If we make a habit of always expecting the best to come out of everything that we do, we will have one of the keys to a successful life. Where do our expectations come from? And our expectations, we find, come from our beliefs. They come from our fundamental beliefs about ourselves and the world around us. In other words, Our expectations are manufactured to the degree to which we believe the source. If the person who told us that we had won $1 million had never lied to us and was someone that we trusted implicitly, to the degree to which we believed that person, our expectations would be manufactured, which would generate our attitudes, which would affect our results. So our beliefs are very important. And then we go back one step further. Where do our beliefs come from, especially our beliefs about ourselves? And that brings us to the most important single breakthrough in psychology in the 20th century, which is our understanding of the self-concept. Our beliefs are based on our self-concept, and every single one of us has a self-concept which is the controlling factor on our performance. We always perform in a manner consistent with our self-concepts. Our self-concepts precede and predict our levels of performance and effectiveness in everything that we do, and we can never perform in a manner inconsistent or contrary to that basic self-concept. And our self-concept is a combination of all of the ideas, thoughts, pictures, experiences, things that have happened to us over the course of our lives that come together to form a composite image of the person that we believe ourselves to be, and we always act in a manner consistent with it. We know that the average person uses less than 10% of their potential as a human being. Some researchers today say that it's less than 5%. Recent indications suggest that it's closer to 1 or 2%. And we also know that there is a direct relationship between our level of performance and our self-concept, between our levels of effectiveness and our concept of ourselves, that we never perform at a higher level than our self-concept level of performance. And if we wish to raise the amount of our potential that we use, we have to increase the height of our self-concept. We also know that each person has an overall self-concept, but we also have 200 or 300 mini self-concepts, self-concepts that govern and regulate every single area of our life that we consider important. For instance, we have a self-concept of how we dress. We have a self-concept of how much we weigh. We have a self-concept of what kind of a parent we are, what kind of a child we are, what kind of an employer we are, what kind of an employee, what kind of a husband or what kind of a wife. We have a self-concept of ourselves as how well we drive. For example, men have a universally high self-concept of themselves as drivers. All men consider themselves to be excellent drivers, and any woman who has ever had the opportunity to correct a man's driving knows exactly what I'm talking about. It is not well received. Women have a high self-concept of themselves in the way they dress, but we all have self-concepts of the way that we perform athletic activities. And if we play several different sports, we have a self-concept for each of those sports, which controls how we perform. We have a self-concept for how musical we are, what sort of public speaker we are, what sort of human relations we have, what sort of attractiveness we have to others, how popular we are, how likable, how lovable, how attractive, how intelligent, how well we learn, how well we concentrate. We have a self-concept of ourselves for languages and for mathematics and for history and for various subjects, how well we read or don't read. We have a self-concept of our own vocabulary. In every case, the self-concept acts as a regulator that controls how we perform in that area. Our overall self-concept is an average of all of those self-concepts in every area of our life that we consider important. And the self-concept is made up of three fundamental ingredients. These three ingredients and the understanding of the self-concept are the key to understanding and unlocking human performance. The first element of the self-concept is what we call the self-ideal or the ideal self. Every one of us has a bundle of pictures and feelings and thoughts of the ideal person that we would most like to be. It's usually a composite of all the people that we have admired, the role models that we've had, the teachers, the parents, the people we've read about, movie stars, friends, and so on. A combination of characteristics. And that's our ideal person. That's the person we would most like to be. That's the person we continually strive to be more like. And this self-ideal acts as a directional mechanism in our lives, in that we are continually adjusting our behaviors and our actions and our words to try to be more like that ideal person. If you wanted to pick one word that summarized everybody's self-ideal, the best word would be that of a winner. Everybody wants to be a winner. Everybody wants to feel that they are a winner, however they define winning. Each person needs that feeling of being successful, of being valuable, of being a winning human being, and we're continually striving to achieve that. We know that people who have a constant series of winning experiences, usually self-controlled and self-directed, are people who have high positive self-concepts, who feel good about themselves, and who perform at high levels of effectiveness. The second part of the self-concept is the self-image. The self-image is the picture that we have of ourselves performing. It's the way we see ourselves and the way we think about ourselves. It's been called the inner mirror, if you like. And whenever we go to do anything, we have a picture inside of us, a self-image, that regulates our external performance and our conduct. We always tend to walk, to talk, to sit, to act, to think, to interact, to relate to other people in a manner consistent with this self-image or this inner mirror. And we know that if we wish to change our external performance, we have to change this picture. And the work that has been done in self-image psychology overwhelmingly demonstrates that if we change the picture that we have of ourselves in our minds, we change our external performance, that we can replace an old negative picture or ineffective picture with a new positive picture of us as effective human beings, and that's the way that we'll perform. The third element of the self-concept is what we call the self-esteem. And the self-esteem is the root of self-concept. It's the very core of human personality. The self-esteem is generally agreed upon by virtually all schools of modern psychology to be the most important, the most critical element in all of human performance. The self-esteem is how we feel about ourselves. Now, our self-ideal may or may not be realistic, and our self-image may or may not be consistent with reality or consistent with the way other people see us. But our self-esteem, how we feel about ourselves, is always true. Whether positive or negative, high or low, it is always true. And the best definition of self-esteem is how much you like yourself. How much you like yourself is the most important single statement about you as a human being. How much you like yourself determines how well you perform in every area of your life. How much you like yourself as an employee, how much you like yourself as a parent, how much you like yourself in terms of physical fitness and physical attractiveness, how much you like yourself in terms of your relationships with other people, how much you like yourself as a public speaker, how much you like yourself as a teller of jokes, how much you like yourself as a person who can learn various subjects. How much you like yourself is the most important single statement about you as a human being. It is the very core of personality, and the more you like yourself, the better you perform in every single area of your life. And we know that since you become what you think about, that if you say over and over to yourself, I like myself, 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 I like myself. If you say it with feeling and believe it, and say it with emotion and with enthusiasm, every time you say, I like myself, your overall self-concept goes up. Every time your overall self-concept goes up, your ability to perform in every area of your life goes up simultaneously. People who genuinely like and accept themselves as valuable human beings find that they perform at higher levels of effectiveness in every single thing that they attempt. And we recommend to people who have not heard this before that they say, I like myself, I like myself, I like myself, over and over again, 5, 10, 50, 100 times a day. Say it over and over and over again until it is driven so deeply into the subconscious that everything that you do is a reflection of a person who has high, genuine levels of liking and self-acceptance. There are many myths, if you like, or misunderstandings in modern thought that get in the way of our liking ourselves. And let me just mention a couple of these. Many people think that it's not nice to like yourself, that somehow people who like themselves are not the type of people that we want to be like. We've heard the expression, he or she likes himself too much, and we don't want to be like people like that. This is a confusion, and this is mistaking self-liking for the same characteristic as vanity or arrogance or conceit or pushiness or aggressiveness or obnoxiousness or being overbearing. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. People who genuinely like and accept themselves, people who have high positive self-concepts, only manifest this in positive interactions with other people. Individuals who have what we call the superiority complex, where they are vain and arrogant and pushy, or the inferiority complex, where they are withdrawn and insecure and unsure, are both extremes on opposite ends of genuine self-acceptance, genuine self-liking. People who genuinely like themselves and accept themselves as valuable persons like and accept other people to the exact same degree. People who do not like themselves compensate for it by either feelings of inferiority or actions of superiority. We also know another thing about self-liking, is that it is impossible to like or love anybody else more than we like or love ourselves. And at the same time, it is impossible to expect anyone else to like and respect us any more than we like and respect ourselves. So how much we feel for ourselves, how much we genuinely like and accept ourselves, forms both the outer limits and the inner limits of our relationships with other people. We can never enjoy better relationships with other people or have them enjoy better relationships with us more than we like ourselves. And every single time we say, I like myself, I like myself, I like myself, if you don't believe it, go and look in a mirror and say, I like myself 5 times and try not to smile. It's almost impossible. Saying I like myself is a purely positive affirmation which causes us to feel good about ourselves all over and causes us to perform in a more effective manner in everything that we do. Many people have taken this course who are in sales or who are in public speaking or who give public presentations, and they have found, as we have found, that if just before a presentation where you are nervous or a little bit tense or uneasy, if you'll take a few minutes to psychologically pump yourself up by saying, I like myself, I like myself, I like myself, I like myself, we find that there is an opposite relationship or an inverse relationship between self-esteem and stress, that the more you like yourself, the less stress you suffer. The higher your levels of self-esteem, the more calm, the more relaxed, the more positive and confident you are. And the more you boost yourself by saying, I like myself, the better you perform at everything that you try. Something to attempt whenever you're feeling a little bit nervous or uneasy for any reason, you can allay those feelings by talking to yourself in a positive, strong, assertive way and telling yourself that you like yourself. So our question, of course, has been, going back further, why is it that so few people like themselves? Why is it that the great epidemic of our society today is low levels of self-esteem, low levels of self-liking and self-acceptance? In fact, many psychologists say, and I agree, that the root of all personality problems, all behavioral problems, all difficulties in interactions with other people is low self-esteem. It is people who do not like themselves, people who are down on themselves, people who do not believe in themselves, people who do not consider themselves valuable and worthwhile, and it is always manifested in our interactions with other people.